of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Where we visit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Kaylin Egan. His name is Travis Centel.
Here's why. Listen, I don't want to talk about the intro every time. I don't want to waste time, listeners' time. But
you created that situation.
But here's the thing. I don't believe you anymore when you say this is a time capsule for Dallas. Because now he's like, oh, my dad fucking sucks.
No, he's like, my dad was hilarious.
Yeah, that's, well, because
what he
to
needs
it at
to understand
three.
Is that when you do like a thing that fucks with the how the show is supposed to start, I then have to like respond. And I know that that's not entertaining for anybody except me.
Only in the whole world.
Yeah, but it's so worth it.
Welcome to the episode, guys. Thanks for joining us. We're happy to be here. We're going to regale you with tales of Hollywood cinema and exciting reviews of past movies and exciting and invigorating analysis. It's going to be great.
Yeah, that's kind of what we do.
Yeah, we're going to do this. It's going to be a great...
Today we're focusing our insightful laser on The Brave Little Toaster, which Travis is dying to watch.
I have an honest question for you.
Yeah.
Do you can't say it's a wash. You have to answer in the positive or negative to this question.
Okay.
Has this podcast made you like movies more or less? You cannot say the same.
But of course the answer is the same.
Yeah, but you can't say that. That was the stipulation of the question.
I think the answer is less, but when I see one that's good, it reminds me why movies are so valuable.
Yeah, I thought Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, if we hadn't pulled that week, I would have had a nervous breakdown. And I mean that very sincerely, that the first 10 episodes of this podcast, I was like, I can't fucking wait to do this podcast. I'm so into it. These movies are awesome.
Well,
we're revisiting great classic movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might
let
suck.
Let me just talk you down on this for a minute.
I
think that now you're starting to communicate to our listeners your a sense of frustration with the whole endeavor. And
why?
Now,
what gives you that idea?
Well, we're starting to get feedback to that effect, which is like, is Travis okay?
I mean, of course I'm exhibiting that. Let me rephrase that.
But they're also like, I think that there's a growing sentiment. You know, we had a comment from a listener who is an old friend of mine. And I think he didn't mean this in any negative way. Obviously, he meant it in a positive way. He's like, does Travis realize how valuable he is to the show? And I was perplexed by that until Eve reminded me, my wife reminded me, that he had probably just listened to you go ballistic about how horrible movies are.
Let me just say this. I don't think his comment had to do with that personally.
You don't?
I don't think that. I think that we have intentionally chosen and leaned into opposing dynamics for the show. I don't think this
opposing
is necessarily,
I think that we've agreed on 90%
of
every movie we've
watched. I don't mean opposing sides ideology driven. I think personality wise, we have leaned into opposing personality types just to sort of further the podcast. And so, you know, I think that helps.
Are you trying to tell our listeners that we are fake? Are we fake versions of ourselves?
No, you always talk that way in real life.
Like how I did the intro, or
yeah,
like right now?
I did the intro.
This is me right now. This is how I talk.
It's a cool guy.
This is just how I talk.
This is the cool guy doing a cool thing.
let's do a real quick process. There's one thing that I felt I blew it on as far as Fear and Loathing goes. And by the way, it was awesome having Jamie on here. It was a really fun, I think, way to watch that movie. And I was very happy that randomly that's the one that came up, because he added a ton to that conversation. So I was very psyched about that. So if he's still listening, thanks, Jamie. But all three of us, and I feel me particularly, I take the blame for this, never once mentioned that part of the visual aesthetic of the movie is based on Ralph Steadman's art, which is inextricably linked to Fear and Loathing, the book.
I forgot this, and Kaylin pulled it up to show me, and I instantly it was flooded with like this sense of course, holy shit. Yeah. He storyboarded the film basically.
Yeah, and Gilliam obviously was an animator, an illustrator, before he was a filmmaker. And, you know, he did all the Monty Python cartoons, which have plenty to do, you know, with both the era that Stedman art came out of. I mean, it sort of seems to be drawing from the same kind of 60s, you know, style. And the R. Crumb style, you know, all those illustrators were coming out of the same time and space. And it's clear watching the movie how much he drew from those panels, like those big sort of sketches that Stedman did. And we know Stedman's art so, it's so culturally present. I mean, it was funny that watching the movie, in talking about it, I forgot to even mention it because it really feels like that's a crucial part of that.
I would
visual style.
I would bet that a lot of our listeners may not cue into the name, but the cover art of all the Hunter S. Thompson stuff that you know of, if you think about it in your head, the stuff that comes up, that's what we're talking about. That sort of wavy lined
sketch, you know, raw, sketchy, splattered with paint. Sometimes
it's a perfect visual aesthetic too.
Yeah, and it's and Gilliam probably that was his rock as far as beginning to conceive of the visuals for the entire film. So it's an important thing to note. And with that, I think we can move on to another
animated classic.
So here's the thing. I don't know much about Brave Little Toaster. This is one where I've never seen it. You know, we've been here before. We're now the two of us are going into this thing blind.
Is this the first one that neither of us have seen?
No, we had one.
Maybe Police Academy 5.
Yeah, yeah. Well, clearly.
But was there a different
one? No, I'd seen Police Academy 5. There was another one that neither of us had seen.
Okay.
But this one, you know, it's one that, here's what I know about it, okay? And now, well, actually, you know what? You go first.
Do people? I want to know if people know it. Like, I'm curious now to know. I mean, just to circle us around.
Are fucking not excited about.
Oh,
this.
I'm getting there. I will be honest.
You to do that. Like, be sure that you hit that before I try to give you a little bit of perspective.
I can't not hit that right now. Okay. In my where I am in this podcast, I want to know, and I'm curious to know if people know this film. This is the first movie, I think, in the bag that I had never heard of.
You've never heard of it?
I never heard of it. I'd never heard of it. When he said The Brave Little Toaster, I had a sinking sensation in my stomach. I felt a little nauseous. I felt a mass wave of disappointment because we come off something I thought was intellectually interesting. I felt like the endeavor we were going through was valuable for a brief period of time. It was like slogging through the wasteland. And then coming on like a little oasis, a little bit of water. We had a little bit of water. I felt good about us as people. I felt like, oh, cool. I went to college. This is okay. And then he pulled Brave Little Toaster. And I just felt like this wash of what the fuck are we doing again? Because it cannot be anyone's favorite movie. I'm not going to get worked up. Don't worry. But it can't be anyone's favorite movie if I haven't heard of it. I feel like I had to have heard of people's favorite films, I think.
Okay. Well, I do think a lot of people know it. I do think it has registered for a lot of people who are our age, maybe, you know, a little
Jamie
younger.
Jamie knew it for sure. Jamie definitely knew it.
He knew it. And did you know that he was like, oh, like he was a little bit excited for us to watch it.
Can I just say one thing about Jamie Wax? He is the most positive, kind, caring person I know in my life. I mean that very sincerely.
Yeah, yeah.
He...
God, that didn't stop him from throwing Garrison Keillor under the fucking bus.
The worst interview
Holy shit.
He has ever done.
Like
Shitty
the old
Charlie
that old
Rose.
Man doesn't need to be kicked. He's near death, Jamie. Yeah, you don't need to be so
up.
Hard on the guy.
But I really believe that if it would have been a movie he genuinely liked, he would have been like, oh, guys, awesome. Instead, he was like, oh, awesome. This will be really fun. Yeah. That means he knew.
Oh,
that's
bullshit.
My read on Jamie Wax.
I think he knew that there was something interesting here. So here's the thing. Here's what I know about Brave Little Toaster is that it has in its bones the genesis of Pixar. And it has a lot of the Pixar people involved in the story.
I'm perked up now.
And in the conception of it, and in the sort of, it was the first movie, I believe, that John Lasseter pitched to be his first CG animated film.
You know I like John Lasseter.
I mean, he's an interesting guy.
I like him.
And I know, I don't know how, to what degree his fingerprints are on this, but I know that like one of their, like Joe Ranft, who was a key member of their Pixar story department in the early days when they just started, co-wrote this film.
What year is this film?
88?
Wow.
89?
And Iron Giant was what year?
Way after.
Right. Okay.
So these guys are just coming out of CalArts and stuff. But
just
like
young kids.
At this point at Disney, maybe not at Disney, but somewhere around there, you know, John Lasseter worked at Disney and he was developing projects for them. He tried to do like Little Nemo. He tried to do stuff like that. And he was experimenting with CG. Even then, I mean, this is the era when they were putting CG into Oliver and Company. They were putting CG into Little Mermaid. They were about to do it into Beauty and the Beast. Like, they were experimenting with computer graphics. And he was doing his own little test CG films.
Is Brave Little Toaster animated, right?
It's hand animated.
Right. It looked that way when you pulled it up.
Yeah, yeah. So it went through. So that was, I don't know that it, I don't know the facts out here very, very intimately, but I know that this is all kind of swirling. This is the era when they were trying to make their breakthrough.
Okay, this sounds okay then.
And this is, so I think that this is going to have a lot to do with the way they design stories and the anthropomorphization of inanimate objects, which obviously Toy Story and, you know, any number of other things that have come after owe a great debt to. So that's what I think they thought they were doing when they built this project.
Okay, that feels appealing to me.
And it's based on a book or a short story.
What made me sad, so Kaylin pulled up the film and was spot checking it. And the one line I heard from the film was, they're on a raft going down a river or something. And one of the guys goes, I almost had to cash in my warranty card. And I just thought, oh no, I don't know if I can do this.
So... But this is a great...
That's a fair response
fine,
to that
but
line.
And look, it would be valuable... This is a case where I do kind of wish I'd done some more research because I think there'd be enough... It's better to put you in a certain kind of frame of mind as you go into this movie.
Well, I feel relatively optimistic about the idea that it involves the Pixar people.
So
that feels
that's the thing cool. to keep in mind is okay. that what we are going to watch now, you know, 20, 15, 18 years after the fact is the people who would go on to create Toy Story, you know, Monsters, Inc., Bug's Life, Finding Nemo, you know, all that
stuff.
Well,
the story development process of Pixar has always interested me, and I've read everything I could find about that.
And I've never seen this movie. I've never seen Brave Little Toaster. I've read about it a lot because it has this kind of inception moment for some people.
Here's a question for you before you go on with that. Is this universally considered to be... would other people echo your sentiments is I guess what I'm asking. Like if I asked someone who knew about movies, hey, is what's the sort of inception film of Pixar, or name a couple that would be considered sort of inception films of Pixar, would this movie come up?
I think so.
Okay.
That's interesting. it just has those guys involved. Mm-hmm. And I don't know to what degree. I don't know what the combination of people were. I know Lasseter wanted to do it. I know he was involved in it. And I know this guy, Joe Ranft, co-wrote it. And that
Joe Ranft, I don't know his name.
He's one of the story department guys. He's dead. He died relatively early in the Pixar story. Like he died, you know, by after they made 5 or 6 movies or something like that. And everyone was very sad. But he was like a car accident or something.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh at that. Everyone was very sad.
They were, yeah, I remember. Of course, yeah. And I didn't really know him as a guy until they were like, oh shit, we lost one of our key players when he died today. And everyone was all like, oh no, Joe Ranft of all guys. R-A-N-F-T, by the way.
Ranft.
So anyway, so look, I don't know that this movie is going to be great, but I hope to see the DNA of all this stuff that I think was good. And now what I'm really interested in is, can we see in raw form what blossomed in early Pixar and what for me and maybe others has soured in late Pixar? And I'm not going to go so far as to say they're completely garbage now. They've lost it. But like, dude, I watched Finding Dory the other day. Mm. That movie sucks. Mm. And I was really crushed by how bad it sucked. I love Finding Nemo. Love it.
Yeah. I mean, Pixar, I mean, this is not a contentious statement, but Pixar's grasp of story and structure and the way they go through it and massage it out is awesome and really smart and fairly egoless in a lot of really cool ways, I think. So,
and they've turned, you know, through no fault of their own, they've turned corporate, they've turned Disney, and they've turned kind of machine. You know, I mean, Lasseter's overseeing all these departments now. You know, they've been through two now. They're coming up on 3 Cars films. It's like they're a different animal. They're the man. They're the establishment now. And so
all that indicates to me that this movie should be awesome.
I agree. Or at least the prototype of awesome. Like, well, that's what I might, even if it's not super, super fantastic. I really hope to see into it.
I don't think this is necessarily true, but it is certainly occasionally true that you try harder when you're younger and hungrier, that you just work harder.
I agree.
And I wonder if this is going to be a sense of them really working hard to make an impact or make, they need a break, you know, they need to do something cool. And the fact that people know it at least means that maybe they did.
And I think that the other thing about its reputation is it came out and people were like, whoa, wait, like this is like something. And
well, it worked. Whatever they did worked, yeah, I guess. Because yeah, it's the people have heard of it, I guess. Jamie Wax. Jamie Wax is also a fairly erudite cinephile, so I think he's not a good test audience for. Although he is a good test audience for our listenership, which almost all know movies better than I do.
Hey, but speaking of our listenership, can I take a moment? This is probably the wrong episode to do this on.
Yeah,
but we got to do it.
We'll do it a couple episodes.
Oh, we'll do it a few times. Yeah. Listen, we have a. This is, I don't know how to do this and not
do it at the end
of
the episode, I think, honestly, because I'll forget mid-episode.
I'll forget if I don't do it right now.
Let's do it now, and then we'll do it again.
All right, we'll do it again. Yeah. If we remember, we'll do it again. Listen, we love the, we have people who listen to this show. Like, at one point on some episode, I was like, you know, I don't know if anybody's heard every episode. And then I got streams of this. That's excessive. But I got a lot of texts and emails and phone calls and interactions where people are like, I've heard every episode.
Same.
I've heard every episode.
It's weird.
And I was like, you have? Like, that's like 40 episodes.
And it's like people I hadn't heard any comment from about the podcast, who I haven't seen in a while, are like, oh, I love your podcast.
So that rules. Yeah. I'm so psyched that people are listening to this thing. Our numbers have not changed since maybe episode 5.
But here's the thing also.
They're strong numbers. They're good, cool numbers.
They are, but I'm not content that we understand how the metrics work and that we're looking at the right numbers.
You may be right.
Because for the other podcast I do, it is not, I know our numbers on Podomatic. This is a fucking boring conversation.
It's horrible. I wasn't going to go deep into that. All I wanted to say is that if you listen to this show and you like it, pick an episode. We can offer a couple of suggestions and tell somebody to listen to it. And if you think they would like it, like pick one that's fucking crazy. Pick Cocoon or Police Academy or Short Circuit when we lose our fucking minds, or pick Rambo 2, or pick, you know, one of the ones where we got real or Fatal Attraction where we got real deep on a real cool movie, or you know, and sort of talked about. So anyway, I'm not self-promoting, but I do think it would be really wonderful if we got our numbers up a little bit.
Self-promote, who cares?
You're right, you said it's the age of Trump, so we're all self-promoting.
I said self-promoting is different now, hashtag not my president. But I do think it's okay to do that. And I do think if you like something, share it. It's really cool. And
yeah,
really,
we're
asking you to do it.
The show is obviously free. It will always be free. We'll never charge anything. And it's not like we want zillions of listeners, but there is a waning sense of like, why are we doing this?
That's my fault too. It's because I saw this as an opportunity to have conversations I was already having, so may as well, but have them in a structured environment where usually in a structured conversation you get farther and learn more and get somewhere and have nice commentary on it and learn something. And then I also thought, what an opportunity to see films I haven't seen before or revisit old movies that I really like to think about as an adult or as an intellectual, because I have spent that time in other art forms but not necessarily the film art form. And then we hit a bad stretch and I got a little frustrated.
Yeah, it's true. We've had a rocky patch. It's been a rocky patch. And maybe, I mean, look, I don't want to do this. Maybe we have to do a version of what we did that one time where we pick a few out of the bag and then choose the one that is most appealing. Look, I don't want to change our format. It's fucking awesome. And the fact that now you have to sit and watch Brave Little Toaster is exciting to me. And I think potentially to other people. And I think this is the kind of thing we're doing this for, which is let's look for the things from the era that some people value and decide whether it's worth.
Yeah, I'm into that basic concept. I don't want it to.
In order to get a bigger audience, we need more people to listen to the show.
Yeah,
so,
that's the plug. I just don't want it to become an exercise in Schadenfreude where people are like, tune in to listen to this guy
lose
his goddamn mind.
No, but look, the geek show element is part of the show, and we have to just tolerate that as well. But it's like, that's not going to be every episode. So let's not just go into this expecting it to be bad.
No. I felt sort of like in that space. I think you've talked me out of it using reason, logic, and compassion.
Yes.
And I feel I grant that. And I am not excited, but I am optimistic, and I think this will be a pleasurable intellectual experience, if not a pleasurable emotional experience. So here we go. Brave Little Toaster.
Well, I'm going with or without you.
I say we stay. We'll have a new master anyway as soon as someone buys the cottage.
But I don't want a new master. I want our master.
Well, what about the rest of you?
You boys are gonna need a leader. Why, alone you wouldn't last for 5 minutes out there. I used to be a mountaineer, see? And together, we can stand against the forces of nature.
Were you really a mountaineer?
Sure. Ask anybody. Ask Teddy Roosevelt. Why, we shot moose together on the Klondike.
Wow.
Well, you know, I was thinking you guys will need somebody bright along, too.
Good idea.
Listen to this. World War II, the Normandy invasion. And who's there but Lampy to light the way?
I want to begin with a question.
You look giddy.
Well, I'm anticipatory. I want to begin with the question, what did you think?
How did you come up with that question? That's a really good one.
But I don't want to say anything.
I want to say this. Yeah. I feel reinvigorated about the podcast.
Oh my God.
I do. This really, in a sweet way, turned me around. Because I want to dig more into this idea, but I feel reinvigorated by simple, linear, easy, and yet emotionally sometimes complex storytelling that made me feel good. It made me feel really nice to watch this.
Huh.
I really enjoyed the experience of it. I watched it in one go. Yeah. I wasn't bored. It is an incredibly simple story, but there are some really genius things in it that reminded me of like, oh, simple storytelling can be really great. And I think one of the things we've gotten bogged down in some of the movies that have sucked is the confusing craziness of Jumanji. It's not simple storytelling. Cocoon's not simple storytelling.
Well, you know what was interesting?
Beautiful, straightforward, simple storytelling.
It was, yes, you say simple storytelling, but it's just a simple concept. That's really all I thought about this too while I was watching the movie, which is that it has the same kind of array of random misadventures mm-hmm. that any other bad movie we've watched has. It just has it within the confines of a very clear narrative direction. It's like, okay, well, they're always moving toward the thing that they say they're moving toward.
That's we always bring this up, or I do. You don't actually do this, but like the cohesion of Lord of the Rings, get this from here to here,
yeah,
is so remarkable for simple storytelling. And I don't mean to suggest that it is unemotionally complex or that it's simplistic.
Well, no.
That the linear direction of the narrative really is so smart.
It's something to hang some ideas on. I mean, like the familiarity of this story, they even go so far. I mean, I know it came out before the remake, but they go so far as to say, like, we read a story about a dog that travels across mm-hmm. the country uh-huh. to its owner, yeah. which is the Incredible Journey. So yeah. it's like, they're even saying, like, we know how familiar this is. The characters even know how familiar this is.
Yeah.
So we're just going to go from here to there. And we're going to have sort of experiences and investigations and animation detours along the way.
It takes all the pressure off the audience of wondering what the fuck is going on. It says, here, we'll answer that question for you up top. Don't worry about it. Just enjoy the ride.
To be fair, it takes a little while to get there. And
well, you mean the opening sequence?
You mean the Little Richard sequence.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I was like, yeah. Holy shit.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's perplexed. Do this for the sake of people because it's so easy. So there's a set of appliances that have been sort of abandoned, left over in a sparse mountain cabin. And you get the idea that this was a family summer home, and they've stopped coming. They haven't been there for years. And so these appliances, who relied upon particularly the affection and use of a little boy, are sort of in despair, waiting for him to come back. So, you know, very familiar idea, anthropomorphizing inanimate objects. So they spend their days cleaning the house, waiting for someone to show up. And they finally realize no one's coming. No one will ever be coming. So it's up to us to go find him. So then they start on an adventure across the mountains, across the countryside, trying to get to the city where for some reason they think he is. And I don't remember why they think that.
It's not really explained. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay. So then they're going to go find their who they call Master. They call this little boy Master. And that's it. Then they get in a bunch of adventures and some existential crises, and they grow emotionally, and they realize that it's up to them to sort of, you know, conceive of some sort of independence, and they need to rely on each other to care for one another.
Well, importantly, and on that tip, they obviously, because they are household objects, they all have purposes. They have specific purposes, right. And they learn to use their purposes together to work in conjunction as a team to develop whatever.
I didn't feel like that was explored very thoroughly.
They try. They yeah. certainly try.
And, yeah,
and,
I mean,
and,
it is. There
and
is,
as a
there,
kid, you get it. You're like, oh, I get it.
That's true. And there are some really brilliant things. Like the way they set off is they realize they have to be plugged in to move and to do anything. And so the vacuum cleaner, who's the sort of biggest, grumpiest version, is the only one who can really travel. So they hook up, they find a generator, and they tie the generator to a rolling desk chair, and that allows him to plug in and travel along the countryside, and they all ride the desk chair. So it's like a pretty great little image.
Yeah, it's clever. There. So just to put some context here, the Pixar short with the lamp that you've all seen comes out the year before this movie is released.
Oh, you looked that up?
I did, because I was very curious. I wanted to know this sort of rash of anthropomorphizing inanimate objects, where did that sort of come from? And in my head, the Pixar short was one of the first places I saw it.
Luxo Jr., which is still the insignia of Pixar.
So that's the year before. It's 86. This movie comes out in 87. So, you know, you're in the same basic thing. And the Lampy in this movie, he's called Lampy.
Yeah, or something,
Is, you know, constructed similarly to that lamp.
So there's two things. There are two tracks that we need to walk down right now, since you've raised the Pixar thing, which I know we talked a lot about in the intro. Mm-hmm. We could not... It's almost crazy how hard we hit the nail on the head there. And it's not us. I mean, this is something that I sort of vaguely knew. But having never seen this movie before, it blew my fucking mind. Have you, like, when's the last time you saw the Toy Stories?
I'm going to read a text on this. I texted my girlfriend who loves Jumanji. Just want to say that on air. And she said, I really love that movie. And I
was the Brave Little Toaster?
Yeah. I said, oh, awesome. I'm excited. I'll let you know what I think. She said, it's Toy Story with appliances, not toys. And I was like, awesome. Great. So that's the memory of decades ago she saw this.
Amazingly. And I mean, which, you know, locating that in terms of time is odd, because this came out 7 years before Toy Story.
Mm-hmm.
7 or 8 years before Toy Story. And it took that, like, what's crazy to me is not just that Toy Story is clearly in, you know, has the DNA and the bones of Brave Little Toaster. So does Toy Story 2 and Toy Story 3. Mm-hmm. Like, the entire trilogy of Toy Story is contained in the Brave Little Toaster.
Going to college and all that stuff. Yeah, for sure.
And the set pieces, the character, you know, the bad guy in Toy Story 2 is a toy collector. In this one, he's a junkyard collector, and he sort of strips them for parts in that junk. So let me just, like, walk through the parallels here. So they are obsessed with their master, little boy. In Toy Story, it's Andy. In this one, it's whatever his fucking name is. And they need to get to him somehow. You know, in this case, they've been abandoned. In Toy Story, they get lost. And then they travel through a bunch of adventures, including a nightmarish sequence with assembled toys. In Toy Story, they're toys that have been sort of Frankenstein together. Mm-hmm. In this one, they're pieces of junk that have been Frankenstein together, and they're scared of them. They have dreams about death, which occurs in Toy Story 2, and here is specific to the toaster.
Isn't there an incinerator or junkyard sort of sequence?
That's the big finish of Toy Story 3, they wind up in a junkyard and have existential crises. They even have the magnet character is, you know, sort of like God and sort of like the claw in Toy Story 1, and, you know, that shows up again in Toy Story 3. And then in the end, the boy is going to college. So they travel through I'm serious, the entire trilogy of Toy Story, which took 10 years to come out. It's all in the Brave Little Toaster. I could not believe it as I was watching it, how many beats are present in this little story.
Yeah. And this kind of segues to the main thing I wanted to talk about that I've been thinking about since I watched this movie. The idea of anthropomorphizing inanimate objects allows you to get away with some remarkable things in the guise of a children's film. The opening of the film, the opening scene sequence, the air conditioner, who's a grumpy, curmudgeonly guy, basically commits suicide.
Yeah.
Right?
He just goes insane.
He goes insane and dies.
Yeah.
And then they go off and have some adventures. And then they get to this, they get rescued out of the swamp by this, like, doofus, you know, repairman guy who takes them back to a shop, which Kalen alluded to, where it's sort of piecemealed pieces. But we watch him kill
a blender.
It literally cut its heart out, its motor, and then cut its electrical cord out in a way that is presented as terrifying. And it's interesting because it's a guy, we know what he's doing. He's not doing anything wrong. He owns a repair shop. But from our perspective, he's murdering these objects.
Yeah, and when the toaster has a nightmare, he dreams very specifically of methods to destroy a toaster.
Yeah,
he dreams of forks
and bathtubs.
Which is so crazy and so cool.
And yet you watch it and it's all human emotions. I've been captured and I am in a place where it's a serial killer. It's a corpse laden serial killer den, basically.
Right.
And yet it's okay for kids in that way, right?
Right.
And well, then,
it's the, I mean, and not, I mean, I know I already said this, but it's the same as Sid from Toy Story.
Well, I want to get to that. So okay. I'm leading up to that. And then there is this, I would say, and I want to talk more about this too, this remarkable, there's four songs in the film. The fourth song I think is remarkable.
Oh, the car song?
Yes.
It's very crazy.
It's crazy. It's yeah. It's these cars saying what they were in life and why they were discarded, and then getting crushed to death by a crusher. And the last car says, I worked at a reservation and basically got abandoned. And then that car drives itself onto the conveyor belt and gets smashed.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm watching this thinking, this is so emotionally adult and intense, and it's about, and we'll get to what this does for the movie in terms of transitioning about outliving your usefulness and becoming relevant and staying relevant in a modern world. But it is cars committing suicide and killing themselves.
Well, and you're very right about what creating that, putting that in the context of inanimate objects does, because what you discover in a weird way, discover is a weird word for this, but like, complex human emotions can be rendered extremely broad and simplistic and universal. And so by putting it in the context, not just of inanimate objects, but a children's film, you're like, oh yeah, like these are weirdly simple, but extraordinarily deep ideas.
Well, they neuter the fear while not neutering the emotional impact of it, which is really crazy that that happens. Right. And I was thinking a lot about this watching it, that they've managed to take the edge off the adult emotional impact of it,
right,
while still keeping it really moving and interesting and hitting a lot of those beats. So I found that really interesting. But what I wanted to ask you, all that was a segue lead up to.
Okay.
When they do it with Toy Story, you have human-like creatures.
Yeah.
And that is, I would suggest, a fairly major shift, because a toaster doing it. I mean, listen, guys, at the end of the film, just to tell people what happens if you don't remember, the boy, the human, gets sucked onto the conveyor belt at the end and is about to be crushed himself. We're about to lose a real human life.
That's the great peril of the finale.
And he's holding the blanket, and he's holding the lamp, he's holding the vacuum cleaner, and he's about to be smashed by a smasher. And the toaster,
it's an electric blanket, by the way. Right. They're all electric.
Blanky, right? And the toaster sacrifices himself and throws himself into the gears of the crusher, and we see the toaster get mangled, and it basically commits suicide to save its master,
Happened previously in the film.
But a crazy idea that this toaster sacrifices himself to save his master.
Well, there's a constant theme of sacrifice.
The lamp does it, right?
The lamp does it. The vacuum cleaner does it. Yeah. They all kind of do it.
The blanket sort of does it when he covers them. All that is to say, when you put it into a cowboy and a spaceman in Toy Story, it's a little subtle shift towards up the emotional ladder, right?
Oh, big time.
So,
I mean, what
how interesting of an idea.
Oh, very interesting. And what I would say, the other thing about the Toy Story parallel here is Toy Story is, look, for all these things, The Brave Little Toaster is very interesting. But it's, to me, mostly interesting as rough draft Toy Story. Rough draft. Mm-hmm. And Toy Story perfects it in so many crazy ways, because Travis is right. It by putting that into human looking characters and toys. You know, I mean, what's weird about The Brave Little Toaster is it gets all these ideas, and to me, it's like they're skewed 2 degrees off of what would be more effective. And having seen Toy Story, you can say, well, that's more effective. So the boy is in love with his household appliances. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really make sense. A boy in love with toys makes total sense. You know what I mean? Like
you're 100% right. But I wonder if part of it is trying to see what they can get away with in terms of a children's reaction, because it may have seemed too much. Because I would not necessarily have thought that putting human-looking toys that have real emotions and act like people in real peril would play necessarily to a children's audience. This I could predict would. Even though watching it, I was still amazed and impressed by the amount of emotional.
No, it's true. It's kiddier. It's a lot kiddier.
Yeah. And safer, you know, is what I mean.
Safer, and it look, you know, like the animation style clearly is not the sophisticated thing that Toy Stories are. It, you know, it looks like Disney Afternoon TV animation, which, you know, was largely farmed out.
It's not,
although not entirely. I mean, I read a little bit about how they made this movie, and it was interesting the way that they tried to retain control as an independent animation unit. But you see in the credits, it's just reams of Japanese names. They sent it to the Japanese animation farm, basically, which is also weirdly where they recorded the soundtrack. They recorded the music in Japan. I also want to, but that I want to talk very a lot about the music, because in terms of the rough draft, it's so insane.
Yeah.
So,
well, real quick, can I just, before I forget?
Yeah.
It's a, I think it's important to note that Phil Hartman and John Lovitz are voices in this
yes.
movie.
Well, okay. There's a big Groundlings thing. Like the director, I read this. I read, look, we did research. I did research on
it. I did not do research.
A little, you did a little bit.
I just want to know when that one Pixar short came out.
Yeah. He was a Groundlings guy, the guy who ultimately directed this. So he pulled a lot of those voices, not just Phil Hartman and John Lovitz, come from that group in that era. So in Toy Story, you have Randy Newman songs. Randy Newman seems an odd choice. Who's odder of a choice than Randy Newman? Van Dyke Parks. They're the same guy. Mm-hmm. Like, basically, and Van Dyke Parks does all the songs in Brave Little Toaster. And, like,
all four songs.
Yeah, all four songs. There's not that many songs in Toy Story either. And they're odd. And they're the same kind of odd in Toy Story, although the characters don't sing them, which is a major revision. They're just sort of soundtrack songs that Randy Newman sings in Toy Story. So these songs, like, I don't know that you know Van Dyke Parks.
No, not really.
But
I mean,
he's the guy who wrote, I mean, you know him from, like, Love and Mercy and stuff. He wrote the lyrics for a lot of Brian Wilson stuff in the Beach Boys era.
I know of him through you and your obsession with Beach Boys, but I don't know his work.
And my obsession with Van Dyke Parks. Like, I went to go see him, you know, last year, and he's sort of an old man now. But he very much, like Randy Newman, was kind of obsessed with this sort of Tin Pan Alley style. Who am I thinking of? What's the name? Scott Joplin stuff. Mm-hmm, you know, like he would do very, after he got over his kind of ornate lyricism from the Beach Boys era, he would just do extremely direct lyrics. You know, he got obsessed with Trinidadian Calypso for a while. Like, he's an odd guy, and he's a really brilliant musician. And he also did the music for the Harry Nilsson songs in Popeye. So he's just like, he's part of these guys. He's, Harry Nilsson, Randy Newman, and Van Dyke Parks are like the three weirdos from the era of the 60s and 70s, the weird sort of singer-songwriters. And so it's crazy. And I didn't know this going into Brave Little Toaster. It's insane to me that they started with Van Dyke Parks as the lyricist songwriter, and then revised that into Randy Newman, and Randy Newman works. These songs, they're kind of interesting, but they're pretty bad.
Well, let me ask you a question, because I had forgotten when this conversation started, because I'm so used to this podcast structure, that you had not seen this film either.
Yeah, yeah.
So I keep in my head being like, well, Kalen saw this 100 times.
No.
Okay, so
this was a total surprise to me when I saw Van Dyke Parks
great.
Come on.
Okay, great. So here, my reaction was this. It opens with a confusing 5-minute dance sequence.
Basically. Set to Little Richard. The first song is Tutti Frutti, which goes on fucking forever.
Forever. And before they've introduced any semblance of plot or conflict. It's just like, oh, here's a weird...
By the way, can I say this sequence really bugged me. So the idea is the objects are bored, waiting for their master to come home. So every day they clean. Mm-hmm. If they clean every day, this house is filthy. It's so dirty.
I'm not even going to engage that point. But it's so crazy and so weirdly minutia-driven.
Why is it so dirty?
It doesn't matter, Kalen. It doesn't matter. I can't believe that's what you want to talk about.
They're like, we're going to clean until it's done, just like every day. And it's like, you mean in one day of non-use, it got this filthy?
Oh, man.
It bugged me.
I feel like this is how it must be to talk to me on most podcasts.
But it's because there was like, no story.
Getting bogged down in minutia is like my jam. And like, even
this
I can't,
the only time
even
that
I,
really happened.
Even I can't get bogged down in that because it's so silly. But it opens in this weird sequence that...
I hated that part.
Obviously, I just didn't know what was happening. I'm like, oh, is this a series of like short ideas that are starting to get into a film? I didn't know what was happening. But then... they start to, go into more of a plot. And then when the first song happened, I was so caught off guard. I was like, oh, because the Toaster sings the first song.
Yeah, they sing it, yeah.
Yeah, Toaster played by a female voice.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. And I was like, what the fuck is happening? Like, I was really confused because it came late enough where I thought, oh, this isn't really a musical.
Right.
But now they're singing, and the first song's not very good, in my opinion. It's really weird. It didn't add much
to the
thing.
It's so goddamn literal, which is also the joke about Randy Newman, and Van Dyke Parks is, like, upping the ante on literal. Like, here we go to the city of lights.
Yeah, It's just, it felt like filler. I thought, oh, well, they're expanding. They're just getting to 90 minutes here on this. But then, as we went on... I thought there's a song that happens between. So what happens, a la Toy Story, there's the master has a lot of new upgraded mechanical
to, you know, stuff in his new place. And they, the old stuff, the sort of analog stuff, comes over and gets in a fight with the new stuff. And there's this song where it's a very, like, the 80s version of futuristic sounds, like almost hyper Devo or something. They get in this sort of, like, you know, battle of words. And it's not, I don't think, especially good, but...
No, it's so... I can't, like... Knowing Van Dyke Parks, this is so... and I'm sorry to go on this detour, because I think probably most people listening to this don't really know or love Van Dyke Parks like I do, but he...
certainly none of them.
This song that Travis is talking about, it's one line, and then the next line rhymes. Mm-hmm. And then it's one line, and the next line rhymes. And they are the worst, most obvious rhymes. Yeah. Like, and so...
Here's the rhyme scheme. A, B, B, C, C, D, D, E, E.
Over and over and over again. And it's like, it's so crazy that that's... Like, knowing Van Dyke Parks, I know that he's intellectualizing that, but in this movie, it's just like, why are you making these stupid rhymes over and over again?
Yeah, the music's not very good, but the second and fourth songs, the second song is a Thriller sort of nod. Oh, by the way, the movie's filled with references to other films, North by Northwest and Thriller, and all this stuff.
I found that bizarre.
I want to talk about that too, but... the second song is this sort of horror song where it's a B movie, and it's shot in this very dark, foreboding way, and they're trying to save their lives. And the objects that have been there for a long time in this repair shop are like, good luck, you're about to die. It's just the way it goes here. You
Can
know?
I sing the song?
Yeah, go ahead.
The chorus goes, it's like a movie, it's a B movie show. Mm-hmm. Over. And over.
I like that song.
I like
that
too.
Okay, good.
But they're all stuck in my... I was listening to them when Travis came over because I thought it'd be funny to be playing the Brave Little Toaster soundtrack. And when I heard them a second time, I was like, these are a little better than I thought.
Yeah, yeah. Especially the second and fourth songs, because the fourth song is that one sung by the Cars, which I think is... This is going to sound crazy. Genuinely moving. Like, I was really into it. I thought, this is a great song.
Yeah.
Musically, none of them... I'm sorry about this if this is your hero or whatever, but musically, none of them are very good. And they're not... They feel unrefined. And they feel slapdash compared to what we get with Randy Newman and Toy Story and all that stuff. But they serve an interesting purpose, because four songs doesn't quite make a musical in a 90-minute film. It's almost like just interstitial songs that just kind of delay action at some points. And two of them I found interesting, and two of them I found very sort of annoying.
Well,
I wanted them to end.
Only that first song has anything to do with progressing the plot. All the other ones are just side song detours.
Yeah, they fill up time.
Yeah.
But I would say...
But existentially, like, that's the thing, is, like, they're thematically...
Because I would say the car song doesn't progress plot, but progresses thematics in a great way. Because that coalesces and crystallizes what the movie has done. So the movie sets up analog versus digital and says, you know what, he's moved on. He has no use for the old things here anymore. The society's moved on. You are worthless. You don't have a purpose. And this is a deep message for kids, is that we watch them spend an hour and 15 minutes... understanding that they do have purposes that can work in conjunction with other purposes, that they are a team now, that this Lord of the Rings team going to do a thing, and they have come to realize that they have value in what they bring to the table.
Well, and weirdly, and I found this convoluted and weird, and again, a refinement that they take care of in the Toy Story trilogy, which is that the end of the movie, the kid who's now going to college, he wants them all along. Like, you meet him before the characters get to him as a teenager. You meet him on his own in his house, in his apartment in New York City. And he says to his girlfriend, hey, I got to go up to the cabin and get all my old stuff, because I'm going to bring that to college. Because at college, you use kind of worn out things, including... And he says them all. He says, I'm going to get my blanket, my toaster, my vacuum, you know, my light, my lamp. He says them all. And he's going to go get them. And so then he goes off to the cabin... And I found this very odd, because then in the end of the movie, he takes them to college.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real head scratcher in terms of what thematically that was trying to communicate, except that they were conceding to a kiddie resolution. Like, they couldn't do something more complex.
Yeah, it didn't bother me, just because the movie is so straightforward and linear.
It wouldn't have bugged me as much if I hadn't seen Toy Story 3, in which they deal with this in a much more elegant and moving way.
Right.
And so that's, I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think that's totally fair. But then at the end of the car sequence, it takes this sort of loose idea and really puts an emotional slant on it, which is these cars who are old, battered cars are just saying, we don't serve a purpose we used to, and then basically committing suicide.
Yeah.
Basically...
No, it's in there, for sure.
It's what we could become, these... So it's our little band of intrepid explorers. Totally. They think, oh, this is the thing, and they have to actively fight against it, and show some sort of self determination about escaping from the crusher.
Yeah, yeah. The other topic that I wanted to discuss, and I'm sorry that I was sort of on my computer for a second there, Travis. I'm trying to look up this record because I'm guessing that there's this record I became interested in recently, because I have sometimes eBay records. And there's this album I found out about that I wanted to bring up. Okay, here it is. So it's from 1989. So very close to the era, you know, 2 years away. And it's called Stay Awake, Various Interpretations of Music from Vintage Disney Films. And listen to who's on this thing. It's got Bonnie Raitt, Tom Waits,
Aaron
Buster
Neville.
Poindexter,
yes.
Aaron Neville, Sinead O'Connor, Sun Ra.
That's weird.
James Taylor. It also had Harry Nilsson.
Yeah.
Like it's so weird. Like, I don't know what was going on at Cal Arts where they just brought in all their sort of fan stuff. Mm-hmm. Like that, which is a little, it's the era is perfect. It's a little bit post-60s.
Yeah.
They aren't exactly boomers, but it's the alt rock and sort of alt country of the 70s and 80s. And I just think there's something bizarre about how, like, this gave me a new insight into how Randy Newman landed the gig in Toy Story.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, they just were fucking huge Randy Newman fans because they were listening to Tom Waits and Harry Nilsson this whole time in Van Dyke Parks.
Yeah.
So I thought that was weird. Anyway, the other thing that I really wanted to talk about on this episode is how independent animation feels. Because part of the story of this thing is it was developed at Disney by John Lasseter. Apparently, somewhat famously, pitched it to the higher ups at Disney Animation.
Based on a short children's book.
Based on a short children's story by a science fiction author.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly, minutes after his pitch, literally, he gets a call and they're like, "You're fired."
I didn't know that.
That's apparently true.
Can you imagine? He comes home, it's like his wife's like, "How was your day?" He's like, "Well, I pitched a story about an anthropomorphized toaster who goes on an adventure with a vacuum cleaner. What happened? They fired me."
Yeah. Because he was pitching it as, "I want to do hand drawn animation against computer graphics backgrounds."
Yeah.
And he pitched this whole story and they were like,
"Get the fuck out of our
like,
office.
What are you doing here?"
I love
And so they
that.
Fired him. And so then this story got picked up, this sort of development got picked up by this independent animation house. And Disney like helped like with startup funds or something. But it's indie animation. And so it reminds me, and it's like unpolished in weird ways. Like the voiceover stuff is wrong in weird ways. It's a little bit, it doesn't sound right.
Mm-hmm.
And the animation, they are allowed to do weird things. It looks cheaper, but they clearly are doing more expressive things or attempting to. And it reminded me of nothing so much as the like indie horror movies of 60s and 70s, which is like, it felt the same kind of scrappy as basically Night of the Living Dead, which is like, it's not professional and it's a little janky and it feels weird, but that allows them to do these really unusual things. And I don't think they're always successful, but it's strange to see that in animation. And the other animated films I can think of there, it's kind of like Ralph Bakshi, you know, and it's kind of like this crazy movie that I'm interested in called Rock and Rule, which has the same feeling of like, a commercial animation house trying to do something a little off center. And that's a very bizarre thing. And like animation, we've lost that completely, I think. I mean, indie animation now is different with Don Hertzfeldt and stuff. But like this was, it's people who are professional animators doing something that feels to them more passionate. And it's got all these rough edges. I just found it all very...
Normally, this is something we've come up against in our podcast a couple times, where I think you tend to appreciate rough edges more than I do. In this instance, I really agree with you.
Uh-huh.
I really, really think, for whatever reason, it's some sort of indefinable thing to me, but the rough, sloppy edges of this thing really made it feel emotionally driven to me and gave it a certain amount of heart that really felt moving. And a more polished version of this is not nearly as good. The sort of clunky look of the toaster and the lamp as it gets struck by lightning.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these things to it that just make it a nice, emotionally driven children's story.
Well, and the other thing, by the way, the thing that I was going to say is that the producer of the film, I believe, wanted to cut two scenes. He wanted to cut the nightmare, the clown toaster nightmare, and he wanted to cut the junkyard song. And I don't know how they stayed in, but like
they're remarkable that they're in there. I mean that very seriously. If you look at 1987, this is a straight up. It's called The Brave Little Toaster.
Yeah.
I thought for sure Super Kids movie. It is dark as fuck. Like that junkyard sequence with the cars is crazy. And the fact, again, I said this before, but the fact that the last car basically gives a speech about how I used to work on a reservation, I had a purpose in life, and now I don't, and then drives himself basically into a grinder and kills himself, is so nuts for the last 5 minutes of a children's film.
Yeah, I loved
it. I loved it. I love that they did it, and I kept thinking, I can't believe they're getting away with some of this stuff because they're, you know, cutting hearts out of things and severing necks, basically. And yet, because they are appliances,
and because it's in such a kiddie, you know, stretch and squash animation style. Toy Story, we'd gotten, I don't know how, but somehow, you know, through the golden age of Disney or the silver age of Disney, we'd gotten a little bit more sophisticated with the thematics of animated films. Mm. But like when this came out, I think that this was like prime Saturday morning cartoon zone, you know?
Yeah.
And this is like when Nelvana was a thing and like, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was about as edgy as you got. And it's like, it's all kind of junky. And this feels like that aesthetically. And so it really takes you by surprise when they do things that are more complex or dark.
Yeah, made by adults. Like this is made by grown up people.
Well, which brings me back to the movie references, which I'm puzzled by, but I get it because they're entertaining themselves on many levels.
Absolutely, and different
from entertaining the adults in the audience. These are animator jokes. Like the fact that the main bad guy in the junkyard is Peter Lorre.
Mm-hmm.
Even adults in 1987 don't give a fuck about that. Only people who watched Looney Tunes in the 40s or classic cartoons think that's fun or funny.
But a scattershot, it's almost Animaniac style in a way, of a scattershot level of humor, right? So you'll have jokes like the radio is constantly tuning into different frequencies and stations and giving really old jokes from the 40s, 50s, 60s,
so
70s
weird.
Across a
talking
wide
about
gamut.
Like Pee Wee Reese in, you know, like.
And then he'll say something like, we're going to go north by northwest. Well, look out for low flying planes. You're like, that's a clear movie joke, right? But in audiences, adults will, I guess, get that joke maybe.
I guess.
But it's a different level of joke than a Pee Wee Reese joke or, you know, a Peter Lorre joke. Like, there's all these different levels of comedy. And I think that part of it may be entertaining themselves, but part of it is the opening salvo of this Pixar idea of loading a movie with different levels of humor
across the
board.
That's true.
And it doesn't matter where you come in at, you're going to have something that you think you're clever for catching.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I missed some of the references.
You're
I got the thriller jokes.
I've never thought of that. That is a really smart idea there, which is like a hook for... It's a little... This is going to sound so obvious, but for me, it's a revelation. Is like something like that hooks you in and just tells you to pay more attention.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, no, we are up to things. Like, and even if it's a little throwaway gag or a line, it's a clue that this movie may have more depth. It's not the DreamWorks style of like, we're going to do an adult joke because we can.
Mm-hmm.
This is like this feels like code. It's like, no, look at us.
Animaniacs was the closest thing I could come.
Very, very close. It makes a lot of sense.
You know what I'm saying?
100%.
I also
but there is art going on here.
And we're
trying to achieve a lot of things.
I'm really interested too, and this is sort of a mild tangent, but watching this film in a different way than Toy Story for reasons we've sort of explicated, but the idea of how we project self as human beings and how we talk about emotional integrity and whether we call it a soul or a persona or a being, we can recognize that in lamps or blankets or vacuum cleaners. You know, there's a sense of there's something about people. And it reminds me of this psychology experiment in a loose way that they found that we have a hard time. If you take a picture of a forest, and you say, you tell a subject, stab this picture, no problem, you have a piece of paper. And if you give them a picture of a person they know and say, stab that, they can't do it. And of course, like you hear that, you go, of course they couldn't stab it. But why? It's a piece of paper the same as the picture of the forest, right? But there's something about projecting personas or spirits or souls or beings onto things, and we imbue them with meaning. And the idea that in the 80s they said, well, what if we did that with appliances or objects or trees or what, you know, whatever, and said, what if this works? And to see how effective it is in this opening stage.
Well,
really,
and what it gets right, what I think it gets really right about childhood, and perhaps even more so in some ways than Toy Story, because it's more, it's more the way a child's mind works, is that you don't, it doesn't need to be a toy for you to imbue emotion into it. It could be anything. And yeah. that children bond on a personal basis with objects, with things, you know, that seem important to them, and they personify them. I remember doing that certainly as a child.
Oh yeah.
And so that, even though I said that that was a sort of a flaw, it's a rougher idea than toys, it's just a slightly less direct idea. And it's very interesting that that's what they would first think of, you know, as like, well, we bonded with our toaster, or, you know, I had love for a toaster. And when I remember, actually, this just reminded me, there's a Philip K. Dick story called The Short Happy Life of a Brown Oxford, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is about a shoe that comes to life. And we were trying to develop it with some agents and producers or whatever. And we kept getting shit about, like, no one's going to love a shoe. So the main character has to be this guy or this kid, or like some crazy experiments. Like, what if the main character is the animating machine? Because that's closer to something people can identify with. And I was like,
the toaster.
I was like, it's easy to love a shoe. Yeah. It's so easy to fall in love with a shoe.
It's harder to love a toaster.
Why is this complex?
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe the lack of imagination on there. So
the next day, Kalen was fired.
So I pitched it and I got fired. I still think that could be a great story, Short Happy Life of Brown Oxford.
Yeah, I think so too. I like it. And I also like the idea. Well, two things. One, the blanket has this classic little kid voice. I don't know how else to say it, but if you hear it, you instantly go, oh, that thing.
Yeah.
Because you've heard it in other things. I love that kid
voice. I loved it. I loved that they had a child, and that, like, there's this really interesting moment in the movie where, which isn't set up well, but I was interested by what they were going for, which is, like, they're in the middle of the forest. They've been going a long way and they're feeling tired. So they all sleep, and each object chooses specifically to sleep alone.
Yeah.
They don't want to sleep with each other or near each other. They want to have their own space. And the blanket, which is a little child, keeps trying to go to each one of them, including the toaster. Mm-hmm. And is like, can I sleep here? Can I sleep here? And they're like, get out of here. Like, we're not the master. They keep telling him to go sleep by yourself. Get out of here. And so, and it's like, it's emotionally aggressive in that moment, because you're like, why are they being such dicks? But the thought process behind, they don't understand the concept of caring for someone else. They are cared for. They
and then
are
the toaster discovers it.
And then he discovers it. And but he, like, finally takes care of the little
very
the
verbally
blanket.
Discovers it. And yeah. then the lamp goes, why did you do that?
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, it makes me feel good, basically, yeah. to do this.
And that, I felt, I always want, that's the thing about the ending that bugged me, which is, like, I thought they were cruising toward a sense that independent value mm-hmm. and self-worth and, you know, connecting with your friends and being sort of there for each other is the point, which Toy Story refines mm-hmm. and figures out. Even though they still need, like, a child to love or whatever. But this one, it doesn't really fully explore that, because they just go with the boy anyway.
Well, what's so interesting about this, you know, they've chosen five objects, and one of them is a classic loved object. It's, you know, Velveteen Rabbit style. It's a small blanket that the boy right. held, right? And it's the other objects are not lovable. It's a right. lamp, a That's radio, right. a toaster, and a vacuum cleaner.
That's right.
They pick things that are not lovable
That's
objects.
Really true.
And so the movie becomes, in a lot of ways, and especially in the end, in the junkyard sequence, becomes about usefulness as opposed to emotional attachment. So it's, do we still have a purpose?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
this movie, mm-hmm. the target is a little bit about right. purpose and right. use, not right. about, does he still love me?
Right.
So the blanket, right. which could play Velveteen Rabbit style of, like, do you still love me? It's not that. It becomes about, do you have a use for me now in right. my old age? And it's a weird commentary on the late 80s in a lot of ways, I think. You know, it
yeah,
ends
yeah,
up
yeah.
being this thing of, like, do we throw this out or do we fix it? Do we repair it? Do right. we keep it? And, you know, there's this tropey meme that goes around about, you know, it'll be a picture of an old couple and saying, we're still together because in our day, you fixed a thing, you didn't throw it out.
Yeah, right.
Right. So, but there's, like, you can't avoid those memes when you watch a movie like this, because you think, well, cool, yeah, they do. And the movie ends with him repairing the toaster
totally.
That's been mangled, and says, no, I'm going to keep this toaster. This is the one I want, even though it's fucked up now.
Yeah.
I'm going to make it work for myself.
Yeah.
And there's something about that.
And that you're right. And they present that as an odd idea, as an odd trait for the character, for the
yeah.
boy. I mean, the girlfriend's like, why are you doing this? Why don't you go buy a new toaster? And he's like, no.
This toaster.
Yeah, I want my toaster.
Yeah, and he's got a room full of gadgets and tech and stuff. So it becomes
I like that.
It becomes about that, you know? And
very,
it's
very
it's a different sort of laser than you'd expect it to have, and different than Toy Story has, for sure.
Totally. You're right. Wow. Well, it's very – well, so, like, I all of that said, I am not sure I would recommend it. I would.
Here's what I would say. And this is a movie I say, if you have kids, show it to your kids.
Like little kids. Like a 4 or 5 year old can watch this movie. And yeah. And in that context, you would be very interested in it, I think.
I think so too. And you would have interesting things to talk about with your child, because depending on where they're at, this will hit them at different levels.
Yeah.
But I found, after coming off a string of, you know, Police Academies and Jumanjis in this podcast, I feel great about the concept of film. I feel invigorated, and
see, this is that question you asked me before, man. Like, do I like movies more or less? This is the kind of movie that makes you realize that, okay, there's a lot of junk out there, so to speak.
Jesus, man.
But the ones that are worth loving.
Well, I can't stand what you're doing right now.
Make you feel so good and make you respect the art form so much.
Well,
so,
like, there's a lot to take from this. One is, I like movies now more than I did in the introduction to this episode. But also, I think there's a lesson for writers here, too, of just don't be afraid of simple, straightforward narratives, then loading them with complex ideas.
Which will let you do so much. I totally agree.
We're guilty of that so much, I think. And
Over-complex
storytelling. Well, and there's a script we were talking about this morning that it falls prey to this in spades, you know? And totally. I think that this totally. Just is so straightforward. And we can learn so much from the idea of going, cool, here's the goal. Get from A to B, whatever A to B is. And then let's talk about what the movie really is about.
Yeah,
that's where the emotional impact comes from. And I think this movie, you know, fails in certain ways. The songs are kind of dumb. But there is a real emotional core to this. They're trying to say something. They land a message that means something that will stick with you. And I really liked it.
Yeah, great. That's great.
I feel great right now. I want to hug a toaster. I really want to hug a vacuum cleaner and a toaster.
Well, let's see if we can keep it going, man. Right, it's your pull.
I'm going to do
it. It's your pull.
I am good. Will you hold this for me, Kaylin?
Yes, certainly I will.
I want to get a good pull here. And you know, right. Even if I pull a shitty one, I can get through it. So this is awesome. I pulled a fucking great movie.
Really?
Yeah, like a legitimately, I think, great movie.
Let's hear it, Travis.
I almost called you Travis. That was weird. Which actually, for this movie, is not that weird.
Oh boy.
Join us next week for, ready? Being John Malkovich.
Oh my God.
I want this one.
That's a big one.
Yeah, I know. It's a big one we're pulled. And I'm ready to watch it. I feel optimistic about it. I like Spike Jonze.
Hey, remember to tell a friend to listen to this episode.
Pick one friend right now. Pick one friend
and
tell them. And
say,
try
this out. I like this podcast.
Yeah.
And so you might like this podcast. Here's a great starter. If you like that, boy, is there a lot of treasure.
Text it to them or post on your, don't say treasure.
Treasures.
Oh, and post it on your Facebook. Anyway, Being John Malkovich is going to be a great episode next week on
Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?
That was a good outro.